Everybody, this is Adam Shartoff, your host of FilmWax. This is Friday, February 23rd, 2024. It is episode number 795. I welcome you. I welcome my colleagues and producers from Radio Free Rhinecliff, where every week, every Friday evening at 6 o'clock, I'm lucky enough to premiere each episode of FilmWax, and then it ends up on the podcast apps in a little after 7. Anyway, I want to thank everybody and all the great talent there. This is a very special show. A few weeks ago, maybe even further back than that, I saw a graphic, a poster, if you will, for a new documentary about the very popular, almost iconic restaurant in the East Village of Manhattan called Veselka. It's a Ukrainian ethnic restaurant, I suppose you could say. And finally, somebody decided to make a documentary about this restaurant, and I was very excited. So I posted on Facebook the poster, and the reaction from people was really surprisingly large, and so many people responded and excited and couldn't believe they were going to make a documentary about this establishment. And you know, it turns out they have. It's called Veselka, the Rainbow on the Corner at the Center of the World, which is a fantastic title, and it's directed by Michael Fiore, and it actually is going to be opening today in the East Village, just a few blocks north of Veselka at the Village East Cinema, which is at, on 2nd Avenue in the Village. I am very excited to bring on the director, Michael Fiore, along with two generations of owners, father and son, Tom and Jason Burchard, who are so central to the documentary. For 70 years, Veselka has been known for its borscht and pierogies, but it has become a beacon of hope for the Ukraine. But it has become a beacon of hope for Ukraine. As the second-generation owner, Tom Burchard, reluctantly retires after 54 years, his son Jason faces the pressure of stepping into his father's shoes as the war in Ukraine impacts his family and staff. The film is narrated by David Duchovny, and we're going to be going right into that. Afterwards, we'll come back. We'll introduce the next guest, which is a friend, Katya Essen, who has a new documentary on PBS's series Independent Lens. And I want to talk to her about that. And that's coming up in a little later. But first, here, check your local listings, by the way, because I think the film is going to be playing in various places, but where there probably is a Ukrainian community. But you know, check your local listings, check Veselka's website. It's their information will be there for other screenings. Again, it's called Veselka, the Rainbow on the Corner at the Center of the World. We have Michael Fiore, Tom Burchard, and Jason Burchard right here. And then we'll have another segment with Katya coming up in a little bit. This is FilmWax Radio.
When I graduated college, my father said, "What are you going to do with your life now?"
And I said, "I don't know."
My father said,
"Well, why don't you come work in the family business with me?"
Cherry pierogies, please.
At Veselka.
Veselka. I bet you half the staff here have been there at 2 o'clock in the morning.
People love this place.
You don't want to break good habits, and it's a good habit.
Thank you.
Jason Burchard has a hunger to feed people, like his father, Tom, and grandfather before him.
My grandfather started this business in the center of little Ukraine, escaping Russian oppression back in the late 1940s.
He opened it as a newsstand, but he turned it into a forum to help Ukraine.
I know that he had dreams of his daughter marrying a good Ukrainian boy, so he reconciled to the next best thing, a good American boy.
Probably then.
After he passed away, people could see that I was going to keep Veselka going.
But the Ukrainian community gave Tom a cold shoulder.
Veselka was a laughingstock. I had to take a leap instead of doing what my father-in-law did.
So give me French fries and...
My father put a lot of hours into the business. He was very hard on me, making sure the details were met.
Our relationship was businesslike, and things were moving at a slower pace than what I would have preferred.
Be careful what you wish for.
Jason took over Veselka when the pandemic hit.
And then, don't think of this as a war in Ukraine. This is a war on a free world, a democracy, and keep the pressure on our local officials.
That New Yorkers stand with Ukraine. It's atrocity what's going on there, Mr. Mayor. I'm sure you're well aware.
Jason has to be the leader at the local level.
A donation?
With food, you can connect anybody.
Veselka has become the hub for helping Ukraine. Jason.
The Ukrainian baseball team is in town.
By you being here, you are a sign of hope.
My Ukrainian staff, they're in a state of shock.
Vitaly, longtime employee, parents are still in Kyiv.
But I'm doing my best to distract him.
Vitaly, I think you need a little practice.
My friends is there and I'm here. I just don't feel okay to, be okay.
We gotta be careful we don't take on too much.
I'm gonna need your help to bring my parents over here.
Jason just says yes to everything.
Let's do it. I've spent more time here than I have spent with my daughter. But we're saving lives from here.
It's good to see you all.
Likewise.
Let me just get a little bit, one thing out of the way. Okay. When I saw the poster, that fantastic poster for the film, and I just because I thought a couple of friends might get a kick out of seeing there was a documentary coming out about this restaurant from our town, the reaction online was so strong. Within a few days, there were like 100 comments and reactions to this post, or people that were like, this isn't real. Can this actually be? I was like really blown away. I'm like, wow. I should have made a documentary about Veselka 20 years ago, but Michael, you did an excellent job. I could not have done anywhere nearly as incredible as yours. And the timing of this is just unbelievable, of course, at the end of the day. Can you?
Yeah,
go ahead, Michael.
I was just going to say, I'm please, always knowing the clientele that you know, has been going to Veselka for 70 years. And I know how many of them are filmmakers, because NYU is obviously a neighbor, and I went to NYU film school. To be the person to tell their story, it is beyond humbling, because they could have had their pick and approval of every pitch from every filmmaker, and I feel truly blessed to be the guy. So I've thanked them before, but I will thank them the rest of my life.
Well, I'd like to hear that story then of like how that you guys did, how it was presented to you guys, and, you know, maybe the conversation that happened where you said, yeah, let's do this. And then also as a part two of the question, I'd like to know the timeline in there with the war, like when that all happened and played out, if you don't mind.
So I met with Tom and Jason. I'd been going to the restaurant for 20 years. Mutual friends and colleagues of ours made an introduction, and this was back in November of 2021. And so at that point, the war wasn't even an idea in anyone's mind other than, you know, Putin's. Yeah. And we got together at the restaurant, and I had already known the kind of multi-generational story, and I knew that I wanted to do a movie with a theme of fathers and sons. Like, that was always at its core. And then Tom and Jason, you know, life happens, and everybody just kind of sat on it for a bit. And when I heard that in early February or late January of 2022, there was all these rumblings of the war may happen, and kind of knowing that Veselka was started by Tom's father-in-law, Jason's grandfather, Vladimir Darmerkwal, in 1954 as a place of refuge for displaced Ukrainians after World War II, I felt like, wow, there's such a, as Jason says in the movie, history repeats itself. Mm-hmm. And I thought there were so many additional potential layers there. So I said, you know, I didn't ever want to exploit anyone or any moment in time, but I just felt like, wow, there's a resonance here that I think if you're going to tell your story, it now is the time. And they agreed, and we started our first day of filming, and you see it's pretty much all of Act One is day 11 of the war.
And by the way, we should also mention, as we approach upon the, or we're approaching rather, the 2-year I hate to say the anniversary, but it's been 2 years coming up on the right next weekend, which is also your opening theatrical three or four blocks away, at the Village East in New York City for the documentary. And then Tom and Julie, Jason, come on, there had to be some major hesitation about doing this. You guys, I mean, from what I can see in the film, the activity, the amount of work required, you literally eat, breathe, and sleep this business, especially now, Tom, as you're retiring. Jason, I mean, what were your concerns, Jason?
I mean, my father has put a lot of his heart, tears, and, you know, sweat into this business. He's been an amazing role model, and we in suffering or persevering through other tragedies such as 9/11 and Superstorm Sandy and the hard times of the 70s, and the, you know, that we knew that, you know, with strength and perseverance that we would weather this storm. And, you know, with the love and support of the customers that came out in droves early on, really kept myself driven, as well as my staff, you know, who are a majority of Ukrainian descent or of Eastern European descent. You would think they want to kind of hide in a hole, that we all came together, not only as employees or as a group here at the restaurant, but the community. So that really gave me the fuel to do and take on the initiatives and raise monies and awareness and the staff being involved. And we continue, like you said, it's an unfortunate circumstance that we're coming into 2 years into this. But I think the movie shows that as a community, we can come together and we can, you know, that expression, we can save one life as best as we can.
Are you saying, though, that you guys saw this as an opportunity? No disrespect to the fact that, you know, Michael comes in wanting to make an entertaining film, but that also this could actually help Ukraine, like that you saw that quickly?
I wasn't sure if it was shot to be for an entertainment scale. You know, my father had been here for 50 plus years. There was something that we knew that there was something here. We wanted to create something along the father and son story, as well as, you know, capturing what this neighborhood was going through during those, you know, terrible times in Ukraine and the trials and tribulations of my, you know, both male and female staff of age to fight. I mean, there were several of them that wanted to go back, but we, through gentle coddling, we said we can do more from here. And realizing now those options, I think they've chosen the right options to stay and to help from afar.
Yeah, Tom, I'd like to hear your thoughts about it. I mean, you're trying to let go, and every time, as Michael Corleone said, different background, different ethnic background, but as he said, you know, every time you try to get out, they keep pulling you back in, right?
Well, actually.
Yeah, I dare you to retire.
he has, but
I know.
As he says in the movie, reluctantly.
Seeing the reaction to this film and having the opportunity to talk to people about it, I mean, that's a total pleasure for me. This is kind of my legacy. I mean, there's something magic about Veselka. I can't really put specifically my finger on what it is or why it is, but just, you know, well, responding to your comment about the reaction of people, you know, now that this film is out, and we had an experience in Santa Barbara where we said to the audience, do you have any questions? What ladies stood up and gave a 5-minute testimonial about how she and her family love Veselka, and she's so glad we're there. So that, you know, that pulls me back in enthusiastically. You know, it's a daily kind of revelation, reminder of what was created there.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the main things for me is whatever that is, whatever that magic is, that hominess, that welcomingness was created by a Ukrainian and Polish community that worked with me at Veselka for 50 plus years. And I feel we all feel a strong desire to give some of that back, and to see them have to suffer under Putin's thumb now is just heartbreaking. It's just it's beyond sad.
Heartbreaking is the right description for it. I will share just briefly, because I go back as a New Yorker, and I had my, even though I grew up in New York City, my first apartment was on 15th Street and 3rd Avenue back starting in the early 90s. And I had a first date with a young woman who, at the time, I was a young man. And I took her to Veselka on our first date. And she was wearing a lovely, I should have known better, and guys, don't make an opinion about me based on this, but she was wearing a white top. And she ordered the borscht. And it has the potato, you know. Needless to say, she was so upset when she dropped the potato off her spoon. I just felt so bad. So that's one of my favorite memories. What's that, Michael?
It leaves a mark, but the rest of it can
leave. Exactly. That's going to leave a mark. Michael, but I'm thinking about what a beautiful story there. I was brought to tears a number of times in the film because of the father-son story, because of the Ukraine story, because of Vitaly's story. I guess what I'm wondering is, how in hell did you find, because there's multiple threads in the story, and I wasn't sure what's the backdrop here. I thought we were just going to see a film about blintzes and pierogies, and it is one about that too, but then it becomes the war in Ukraine backdrop, but it's more than a backdrop. It actually moves to the front of this, you know, it takes a more front and central role, that part of the story. So I'm wondering how you navigated that as a filmmaker and a storyteller.
So this, I took a giant kind of creative leap from anything I've made before in making Veselka, and I embraced the challenges and kind of said, let's just see what happens and evolves. And on day one of filming, which was day 11 of the war, which the only, I remember Jason and I talking about this at the time, the only comparable feeling close to what was felt in the neighborhood and Veselka that day was 9/11. I mean, it felt near identical. I don't even know if the movie really fully captures that essence, but what does come across in Act One is that no one really felt comfortable speaking with me, and it was completely understandable. And there's a moment
like the staff, you mean?
The staff. Yeah. And so I never wanted to interject myself into the movie. I never wanted to be a character, but I would always say to Jason, sometimes a non-answer is actually the more dramatic answer, because they're telling you multi-level answer of how they're feeling by not answering. And so at some point in that first day, I was like, okay, well, I'm going to have to just kind of film myself asking people to talk to me, because no one would talk to me. And then over the course of time, I think everybody realized that my intentions and my team's was true and authentic, and we were just there to just share the events as they unraveled. And so I just
a borscht stain on a white top. You ain't going anywhere. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I had to get that in.
Exactly. Well, and I knew that this was something I was going to really have to invest in over time, that the story was going to tell me what it was. And, you know, at the end of the day, after, you know, editing for like over 8 months straight up until like 3 weeks ago, basically, or a month and a half ago, the movie tells you what it is. But also there's a point when you realize what the movie is and you say, as long as my execution of it is solid, and the audience feels like they're the hands of a solid storyteller, people are willing to just take the ride to see, where is this going to go? And as you know, and as the audience will see, it covers the first year of the war. And I would say it's not a war movie. To me, it's the antidote to war, or the antidote to a war movie, but obviously the backdrop and a catalyst is the war. So that was the general journey I took, and kind of just let the pieces fall where they may, and just tried to make the movie, edit the story in an assured way, so that the audience at the very least said, I'm going to keep going, because I feel like this guy wants to tell us something, and we're getting there. Mm-hmm. We're just going to watch it, you know, watch the year unfold in real time, basically.
Well, you have a great team there. So it sounds very organic, but it fell together quite nicely. I really recommend it for people. And the full title, by the way, is Veselka, The Rainbow on the Corner at the Center
at the
center World. The what world. A beautiful title. Yes. Has life returned to normal now that the sort of, well, I guess you're still on this journey with the film, even though production may have ended some time ago. But and is there a normal in the Bierschard life? Either of you can.
Business has returned to normal.
Yeah,
we continue to raise awareness and have different menu items that are dedicated, earmarked the sales for humanitarian relief efforts.
Right,
one of our partners from the beginning of the war and since their inception, Razum for Ukraine, which is a nonprofit celebrating their 10-year anniversary, just had a large press conference and asked us to be a member. You know, we've been a corporate sponsor of theirs since their inception. They're trying to continue. They're having a candlelight vigil this year to mark the 2-year date, and we're gearing up for the premiere here in New York.
Yeah, talk about that.
I think it's a great platform because I think the war news. We live, unfortunately, in a short news cycle society, and as this hot potato in Congress is being passed along and debated, you know, we all have a responsibility to continue to keep the message alive that, you know, this is a small cost to what if we don't do this now, you know, pass the bill to send some more money. What it's going to cost us a lot more down the road. My message all along, we shouldn't think of this as a war against Ukraine. This is a war against democracy.
Democracy, absolutely.
So right. At its heart. So yeah. We have to continue to keep that message. There are a lot of distractions, the political election and unfortunately the unrest in the Middle East. But this is still an active issue that we need to continue to advocate for.
So what are we? Tom, please.
Well,
sorry, either one of you guys. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, you ask if life has gone back to normal. I mean, this is for me. This is better than normal to now have a chance to share this beautiful film with extended family and friends and all of our customers over the years who have supported Veselka. Again, I think there's something magic about Veselka. Largely, it's due to our hardworking and dedicated staff for the past 50 years, but it's also largely due to our customers who really embrace kind of the hominess. We're not a really classical professional restaurant. It's basically a group of grandmas cooking homemade food that we share with people, and that's not a standard form of restaurant management, but it's worked for us and it's created this homey feeling. And so to now be able to share that with, again, family, friends, and all of our dedicated customers over the years, I mean, they created this, and you know, I really feel gratified that we now have the opportunity to share it with them. And you know, I'm incredibly grateful to Michael for really catching the essence of what Veselka is and helping us define it and document it. Yep. And share it with people.
That's lovely. Hey, you know, as I was about to remind people that the film is, for you New Yorkers, is opening on Friday, maybe broader. I don't know. You can let me know on Friday, the 23rd. That's coming right up at the Village East, which is like three blocks north of Veselka. We can talk a little bit about what that's going to look like, the premiere, theatrical premiere in New York City. But I'm also interested in knowing, will Ukrainians be able to see the film?
Very
in
question.
Ukraine? Yeah.
We actually just officially announced yesterday that
we have a news breaking item.
Yeah. We made a deal with the theater chain Planeta Kino.
Oh.
And so the documentary is going to be in 6 different cinemas across Ukraine, Kharkiv, Kyiv, Lviv, and Odessa, starting February 22nd. They do their, we do Friday to Thursday in the US. They do Thursday to Thursday. So they're February 22nd to the 28th. And then our US theatrical is in New York, as you said, at the Village East Cinema, in LA, the Lemley NoHo 7 in North Hollywood, in New Jersey, the Burnsville Cinema 3, in Washington, D.C., the Regal Gallery Place, and that's all February 23rd to the 29th. And then we have kind of small rollouts after that. So in March, we're in Boulder, Colorado for a week at the Dairy Arts Center. And in April, we have an exciting one-off event with some partners in the Ukrainian community in Chicago at the Siskel Center. And then for a multi-day run starting April 12th, we're going to be in Toronto at the Ted Rogers Hot Docs Cinema. And there will be other theaters that pop up, possibly even in the next couple of days for the week of February 23rd, where we're talking to many theaters across the country. So for updates, people can visit us at Veselka Movie on all our social platforms and also the Veselka Restaurant website, which I believe, guys, is just veselka.com, correct?
Yes.
Yep. Yeah, I checked it out. It's all up there. You can watch. We'll have the trailer at the beginning of this interview. I'll put the trailer on so people can see that. And what opening that night in New York City? I mean, this is the local. This is like the, I don't know, the next door neighbor practically of the restaurant. What is that opening night going to look like? Who's going to be there? What's going to be served?
Well, our premiere, so to speak, is the 7:05 show, and it was sold out, I think, within a day of the tickets kind of being like officially announced. But there are 4 or 5 showings every day through the week, and we will be there doing Q&As pretty much every night.
Oh, wow. Wonderful.
After the 7:05 p.m. On Friday, Saturday, and then the Monday through Thursday. And then on the Sunday showing, the Q&A, I believe, happens after the 4:25 p.m. show. Well, there'll be different people throughout the week kind of rotating in and out. But Tom, Jason, and I will definitely be there for sure on the Friday and Saturday.
And Sunday.
And Sunday, yeah.
Speak for yourself. I'm going to Los Angeles.
All right, well, Tom and I will be.
That's great. Does a ticket stub, is there even such a thing? Will that get you a discount on anything at Veselka? That's the question.
There was talk of that. It has not been, let's say, TBD.
Okay.
No.
But you are trying to raise money for the Ukraine. So,
We're announcing that net proceeds, obviously there are some revenue sharing with the theater here in New York, but whatever net proceeds, I am partnering with Razem for Ukraine. And those funds will go to their organization as a donation. They're actively soliciting monies for these medical backpacks for paramedics on the front line. So, and we're always finding ways to partner and raise monies and awareness. I mean, I'm just concerned if we do some kind of offer with the ticket stub. Everything's electronic these days.
No.
There's no more. Yeah. There's no more ticket stubs anymore.
Right. No. Exactly.
We encourage people to come eat borscht, but not with the white shirt prior or after the show. maybe we'll have a special. I'm not sure, but yeah, we're in the final stages of doing something creative to incentivize moviegoers to come visit.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like also you've found during the journey of putting the film out there, and the journey certainly is just basically starting almost theatrically speaking, but that New York City folks, New Yorkers are a diaspora as well, and we're spread out all over the place. And just you'll be able to see the film almost, it sounds like, no matter where you are, even before the streaming begins down the road. So see it theatrically, see it on the big screen.
I may say,
jump in there.
I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but I was
not at all.
Definitely, definitely see it with an audience, because as we premiered last weekend at Santa Barbara and we did two screenings, and then I was able to give an advanced screening the other night to the Picture House Film Club run by critic Stephen Witte. And amongst those three screenings, I always say, you think you know what the movie is, but then when you go in and watch it with an audience, as the filmmaker, you watch the audience, you don't watch the screen. They tell you what the movie is, and they were laughing.
Yeah.
Applauding at moments I never could have predicted. And to me, this is a movie best served with an audience.
Maybe
you will enjoy it sitting someday at home watching it on a streamer. But without a doubt, this is a movie that people feed off each other.
I'm guessing one of those moments may have been when Eric Adams was at the restaurant, but I don't, I'm not.
The Pelham audience, especially. The Santa Barbara audience, yes, for, you know, just kind of generic reasons.
Oh, my gosh.
The New York audience really made some sound.
I bet they did. I only bring it up because, you know, it's in the trailer, so I didn't feel like I was dropping a spoiler there. But it's quite a scene to behold. David Duchovny, a Ukrainian-American actor, does the voiceover. David Sanborn lends his musical talent to the score. It is directed by Michael Fiore, making his first time on this podcast. I'm sorry it's taken so long. I've been doing this for like 12, 13 years, to be honest with you. So shame on you. But and the same diasporas, I think somebody alluded to this earlier, but just knowing the Veselka is there, and when I go down to New York City, I can go stop by, it also gives a level of comfort. And that's what I think you experienced as you travel around, and just knowing Veselka is still there and thriving and is a nerve center, or maybe it's not the right expression, but it does give some comfort. So thank you guys for that. It was remarkable and lovely talking to you all.
Well, same here. Thank you for your insightful questions and comments and
patronage.
And what's that?
We appreciate
thank you for your thank you for your patronage.
Oh, yeah. You're welcome. I'm sending the dry cleaning bill, though, to you guys.
I have news for you. You're not the first to send us a dry cleaning bill. We have a close relationship with our neighboring cleaner.
Guys, good luck with the film, and I'll stop by soon and say hello.
Please.
From the Hudson Valley. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. Bye. Thank you. This is Katya Essen, the documentary filmmaker Katya Essen's first time here on Film Wax. Believe it or not, it's always surprising to me I can go this long, but I ran into her at the Woodstock Film Festival this past fall, and we got to chatting, and I'm just so glad that she has a new documentary called Raising Liberty Square, and that we got the opportunity to finally sit down. Even though she was in Miami and I'm in New York, but we got to talk about her new documentary, Erasing Liberty Square. Liberty City, Miami, was home to one of the oldest segregated public housing projects in the United States. Now, with rising sea levels, the neighborhood's higher ground has become something else, real estate gold. Wealthy property owners push inland to higher ground, creating a speculator's market in the historically black neighborhood, previously ignored by developers and policymakers alike. Katya Essen is an Academy Award-nominated filmmaker based in Miami. She has produced and directed documentaries for PBS and HBO. A Simons Humanities Fellow at Kansas University, her films have screened at MoMA and the Smithsonian, and is supported by NFA, Knight Foundation, IDA, the NYSCA, Redford Center, Sundance, and Ford Foundation. I'm thrilled to bring on Katya Essen to discuss this important documentary, which you can view on YouTube. Go to the PBS YouTube channel, and it is there for you to view. In the meantime, we'll play a little bit of the film, and then we'll talk to Katya right here on Film Wax.
So climate gentrification is happening, and Miami is being affected in the worst way.
There's a change coming to this area.
They're going to come take Liberty City because we don't flood.
All the people that are planning this don't live in this community.
Liberty Square is the heart. And when you destroy the heart,
You destroy the people.
Sorry, hi.
You see? You wait like minutes.
I got caught here in the... Oh, no, no, my son is coming. How are you?
I'm good, how are you?
Good, good. Good, busy.
Yeah, yeah, I bet you are. Well, yeah. You see, we met again at the Woodstock Film Festival, and we laughed sort of about... we were laughing because, what, my memory?
Uh-huh. But now here you are. I was like, okay.
After that, I wasn't going to forget about you again.
I made sure of that. Oh, God.
No. And having had the privilege of watching Raising Liberty Square, you know, I have so much respect for your work.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Your documentary, Raising Liberty Square, is currently available to watch on Independent Lens and on, I guess, stream it also on the PBS website, right?
Yeah, and what I'm really proud of is the PBS YouTube channel. We're nearing 500,000 views. I keep looking at the number. I can't believe it. Yeah, I know. And the PBS can't believe it either.
Yeah. I bet. And are you reading the comments, Katya?
Yeah. I do.
You're mostly supportive and favorable?
Yes. And it's just, many people from Miami, but also many people from Florida, but many people that are saying this is exactly what's happening here. And they're mentioning here, this is our part. This is what's happening. All the cities I'm from, blah, blah, blah. And this is happening here. And that's, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, well, first of all, we're talking about one of the South's, maybe the oldest housing project in the South. And what it in my, and it's specifically Liberty Square is a housing project in Miami. It's been there obviously since the 50s, right?
The 30s.
30s, excuse
deal.
Me.
New Deal. It was part of a New
correct,
Deal.
By the way, I should lay down the ground rules. You're not supposed to correct the host.
Oh, sorry. But you can always edit, right? I mean, and it's going to be jump cut, but you can edit.
But then I don't get the laugh with the subsequent line about, you know, I would just tell people don't correct me on my podcast.
Okay, good.
First of all, it doesn't work. I still make mistakes. So.
Okay.
What I was going to say is, before we, you know, start getting into the details of that, but is I wanted to share with you. I don't know if you know this, but like over 10 years ago, I hosted a series with called Brooklyn Reconstructed. You know, which was a different type of demographic, a different type of situation, but at the same time, they're kind of related because it's all about these, I called it steroidal development, you know, urban development. So where it's not the normal, I mean, there is sometimes the normal, type of urban change and that happens in all cities over time, gentrification. There are natural waves of economics and of all sorts of impacts that, you know. But what happens in cities like New York, starting about 20 years ago or more, is rezoning mm-hmm. and a strategic sort of plan between government and developers of how you're going to change the city, change the skyline, change the neighborhoods in the favor, of course, of the wealthy. So what first charmed me about this idea is I already had this stake in the story, you know, and so I shouldn't say charm, but just sort of appeal to me about the story was that, you know, you see the same thing here in Miami now. The shoreline, so because of climate change, the shore is being affected by climate change, right? The sea levels are rising. Okay. All of a sudden, the shore is actually going to be closer to Liberty Square.
Yeah, the beach is going to be very close to, yeah.
So therefore, their property, that real estate all of a sudden value.
Yeah.
Is now, right? Becoming more and more appealing to developers in the city and the city and the state.
And can I just interject here something because
take it over from here.
That is, you know, what is additionally ironic in a most horrific way in Miami is, you just mentioned the beach, you know, Miami Beach during segregation was off limits for Black Miamians. They had to have an ID card to be able to work there. But, you know, you had Nat King Cole and Aretha Franklin. They all performed to sold out shows at these big hotels, but they could not stay there, you know? Yeah. So it was really this really a horrible history that is now so ironic that now the beach is coming to this place that nobody wanted, you know? And
well, I hope the beach has an ID. Because they're not going to get into Liberty Square otherwise.
Well, they're coming. They're coming. They're coming.
It's in a higher elevation too, right? So we know that people of color were being pushed inland, and so due to climate change, but also because of the appeal of the ocean. I mean, you know, now it's right. That property was always considered far more valuable on the beachfront.
The precious beaches that, you know, they, yeah, exactly. You know, they pushed, I mean, during segregation, there was a part of downtown that was first called Colored Town. Then it became the name Overtown because you always had to go overtown to get there, but it was bursting at the seams, you know, and then during the New Deal, it was like, oh, we're going to build this new colony for you guys. Beautiful. And it was beautiful. But in the middle of nowhere, inland, happens to be on a ridge that nobody, of course, at that point thought about. Now it becomes, that's the topic, you know, that it's right. Sitting high.
Of course, like a Trojan horse, right? The government is trying to, once again, package what their plans as a benefit to the residents of Liberty Square. But of course, you know, we know better. But before we get even further, I want to just take a little step to the side here and find out your relationship to Miami, and we'll come right back to raising Liberty Square, which again is on Independent Lens and on their PBS YouTube channel. Go there. I think every time somebody watches the documentary there, Katya just gets so excited. It's
I know, the numbers are rising. It's crazy. Not me. Everybody's getting excited. We can't believe it.
No, that's great news. I'm glad it is. I don't want to say heartwarming, but it is sort of something's warming up, because it's like it's great to know people are actually interested. Those screenings I was talking about briefly, Brooklyn Reconstructed, by the way, where we showed Battle for Brooklyn, we showed My Brooklyn, we showed Gut Renovation, all these documentaries that were coming out in the earlier part of the last decade, and there were packed houses there. The community came out to these. Brooklyn was coming to these screenings. It was the best idea ever had, in a way. But it was also, we had Trish James coming, who will be in the headlines again today when the decision comes about Trump's court, you know, the New York Southern District Court case coming in today. The decision, and so Trish James, who is bringing down Trump, she would come to the screening because she was an assemblywoman in that area of Brooklyn. We just had packed houses because people, my point is that people are, this is affecting people, everybody. And, you know, you see it happening in your city, what's happening to neighborhoods, not just projects, but across the board, you know, for middle class people.
No, absolutely. And I mean, the screenings that the theatrical screenings that we had here were sold out. We're now started community screenings. I told you that we started.
Yeah, that's going to be a big thing.
Impact. But I wanted to maybe to kind of raise the stakes. I wanted to tell you that it is, you keep very nicely mentioning it's on Independent Lens and where people can see it. And that's great. But it nearly didn't happen. The developer actually went to PBS and tried to stop the documentary.
Wow.
Yeah, well, they did some other stuff too, but they went to PBS and made them very nervous with a scathing letter of like accusing the film of getting everything wrong. And then like it was a scrutinizing day of our broadcast premiere of lawyers pouring over this. And then at the end, finding there was no merit. And then so we, 2 hours before our broadcast premiere, we found out we're actually airing. It was Crazy.
You were white knuckling it there for a little while, as they say. Well, yeah. It's a good story, you know, at the end. I guess, your cardiologist might have a different opinion, but
yes.
Hey, no, so I'm... tell me also, this is what actually I'm so excited to talk to you. I keep getting off track myself. I wanted to start, in a way, talking to you about your own relationship to Miami, this city, because you have had a relationship with that city going back like 40 years. You came from Germany. I have to imagine you were very young, just out of school or something. Right? And you were wanted to be a filmmaker, and you were shooting. How did you get here? And were you shooting music videos or rap videos, or what was the story?
Well, I wasn't shooting. I was a very timid a film student from Germany who did not really speak very well English, and English very well. Look, I still don't speak English, but yeah. a producer that came to our film meeting and said, "Hey, who wants to work for free on cool music videos?" And I was like, "Me, me, me." Little did I know that that would be Two Live Crew shot in Liberty City. And of course, me, with my bad English, I didn't even understand the lyrics. I asked DP that was filming, who is still a friend, who also filmed a part of Liberty, Raising Liberty Square. I kept saying, "So what are they singing?" And he would refuse to tell me, because it was I don't know, can I say that some of the titles? I mean, it was like,
yes, of course you can.
We want some pussy, me so horny, Ben in the USA. I did all those, you know. So
I'm sure your parents were very proud that they sent you to film school. Although now, you know, they didn't have to probably spend very much, right?
But Adam, it gave me a lot of street cred for this film now.
That's true.
But yeah, of course.
You actually, there's nobody you know from shooting there. Your what was the pussy title? I mean, let's say you were working on that shoot, and
I was a PA. You know, I was getting water.
You were a very young lady, but nobody, you didn't know any, you didn't run into anybody you met 40 years ago, right? I mean, it's all new generation, and
yes. But of course, they are so famous here. I mean, Luke Skywalker, there's a screening actually tonight, a big community screening, and he might make an appearance tonight, you know, so Ooh. Let's see. The Luke Skywalker, the Two Live Crew.
Yeah, I remember Luke, but I didn't know he went by Skywalker.
Oh, yeah, he called, you know, now it's called, now he goes by Uncle Luke. He was then called Luke Skywalker. I keep saying Luke Skywalker, but that was his artist. Yeah. Luther Campbell is his real name. Yeah.
That's right, Luther Campbell, of course. Yeah. I do remember Luther. He must be an older guy, my goodness.
Yeah. Not that old, but yeah.
It was very controversial. I do remember that back then.
Yes.
Yeah. So you, to continue the timeline, though, so then after you were working on that, though, that period of time, you left Miami because you were living there. You decided to stay, obviously, and get more work, right? And then you eventually left and moved to New York City, or did you go back to Germany?
No, I got stuck. I really got stuck in this country. I lived in Miami for more than 7 years, and then I moved to New York.
Heaven. Oh, I didn't realize it was that long.
Yeah. It was a long time.
What was that like for you, a young German woman living in what I have to imagine was pretty rough city back then?
Yeah, and I was very much hooked into the Latin culture. So I got married to a Cuban. You know,
I want to make it a little lighter in here.
Okay.
the clouds are coming out. You married a Cuban.
I married a Cuban. Yeah.
Go ahead. Wait.
Oh, I see. Yes. Bounce board.
Works.
Yeah, I was working. I just worked my way up, you know, mostly commercial work, some feature work, you know, from PA to assistant camera to assistant wardrobe to coordinator to AD to I did everything, you know, because I wanted to do narrative really at that point. But after moving to New York, I I discovered so many stories that I wanted to tell, that's how I came to documentary. And then I realized that that's my voice.
That was your calling. Yeah. And I mean, it also took a while for like documentary film to like become a thing. I mean,
right.
Where it was the legitimate like genre of film. I mean,
right.
And now it feels like we're finally moving into the next phase, which is less concerned, you know, with drawing such lines between films, making distinctions about. Awesome. Very good. So, and then you lived in New York City, you're saying, for quite a while.
Yeah. And then in 2016, so I lived there for 24 years, you know, at 2016, I always, always dreamt of Miami.
You did?
Yeah, I did. I always knew I would come back to Miami. So in 2016, I moved back. And that was not just the Trump year, that was also the Moonlight year.
Right.
And then I found out that specific housing project where Moonlight was filmed was scheduled to be razed to the ground. And then I found out, you know, all this historical detail about this place. And then being a European, I just had a very historical interest at first. I just really picked up my camera and I wanted to capture it before it would disappear. But then while being in the community and talking to residents, that's when I was educated. By the way, we're sitting on some of the highest and driest ground in Miami, and there's this thing called climate gentrification that I never heard that term. It was coined in Miami. And then I realized, wow, this is a very, very different film. And that's, and then 6 years later, you know, 6 years later, the film premiered.
Yeah. Wow, it seems like this is the story of your lifetime in a way.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, this film, like every film, really, that I do, but this one definitely changed my life, and also, yeah, it's still not over. I'm still in it. I'm so much in it. I know I won't be done with this because it's my. I'm 10 minutes away from Liberty Square, you know, and of course the developer hates me now, and like the community is asking if I want protection. I'm like, we're not at that point, I think, but it has so much become my community too, in a way, you know, that, yeah.
Sure. And I mean, the film, when the film is ending, and I'm not trying to give away, like, thing, but we see the first phase is conclude, right? The first phase of the redevelopment of Liberty Square is done, right? And, you know, so a certain part of the population that a very small part, by the way, that didn't get pushed out, you can describe it probably a lot better than me, but they were offered housing, right, through what is it?
Yeah. Yeah.
They could move, right, and still pay well below market rent, market value, what have you.
Right.
And the idea being, though, that eventually when the redevelopment's done, they could move back into their apartments, right?
Right.
Or get apartments back in Liberty Square.
Yeah. No, as I was educated to realize, I was definitely, I had to learn about all this myself, you know.
Is that Section 8?
Section 8, exactly. Yeah. Section 8 vouchers. So that's normally, I mean, I think this is the current model of so-called revitalizing low-income communities is turning it into mixed income, you know. So it's a partnership between as a private and public, and money is private and public, and then normally these the buildings are completely demolished. Everybody has to leave. They're getting Section 8 vouchers where they have to look for housing themselves, but it's still the same payment as they had with public housing. It's just they don't have that much protection anymore, which is one issue when some people are not really aware of that. And then, yes, and then supposedly they're allowed to come back. Now, what happens often is that developments take so long, people get lost, that there's something called good standing. You have to be in good standing, which is a kind of like a gray area. So people can also, you know, the I don't know who, but I guess
like one family member who gets arrested.
Exactly.
guilty.
And then, you cannot come back, you know? So all these things have happened, you know, the vouchers, again, there's a different rule. You are suddenly with a private landlord, that's another term I learned, slumlords, you know, that then don't fix your air condition or don't whatever, you know? And then if you don't pay the rent because they don't fix your air condition, then you get evicted. And once you're evicted, you're out of the program. So a lot of things can happen. There are a lot of more costs also for garbage and gardening or whatever, maybe. It's an incredibly complex and complicated situation. Yeah. So this development was so unique and I was so drawn to it. And like Aaron, one of our protagonists, I believed, wow, this could be a chance for something completely different, because the idea was, no, we will not move anybody out. We have enough empty units so that people can, we can do block by block. They're 9 city block. It's huge. It's this development is huge. So we can do one block, move the people within the project in empty units, and finish this block, move them back, you know, add the mixed income in, and then so go block by block. That was the idea. That was the hope. But that's not what happened, because they very quickly came again with these vouchers, said, hey, we have vouchers for you. Vouchers, by the way, that are people are on waiting lists for these vouchers for sometimes for 10 years, you know. So that was also very convenient that they suddenly, then became available and all that. So there's a lot of stories there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think the overriding story is, you know, screw the poor and, make way for the people with the money.
Yeah. That's, seems to be the, no, and it's like we
capitalism.
Keep. In the screenings that we have done all over this country, but also other countries, we went to Germany and England and mm-hmm. went to Korea and India. People ask always, like, is there an example of a successful mixed income development? And we have not found one.
Wow.
Every time I think there is one, there's somebody else coming and say, no. It's... this was a problem here. I mean, there are some that were more successful.
It's part of a smokescreen approach to redeveloping neighborhoods and pushing people with, you know, with less, you know, less means out. I mean, there's this long, healthy tradition of that in our country.
Yeah.
We have a very, it's an uber capitalist country. And I don't know how much longer we can sustain it. We, you know, people, the homelessness and everything else is so out of control. And what is like the homeless situation in Miami like?
Oh, it's out of control. It's growing. People are living in their cars. Families the school that's in the film, the principal, you know, one of our protagonists, Samantha, she spends a lot of time trying to find housing for her families that are homeless or in shelters, you know, and the kids still go to her school, but she's trying to house these families, find something. It's absolutely out of control. Miami was declared by Martha Fudge from the Department of Housing and Urban Planning of HUD, ground zero also for the housing crisis in the country now. It's worse than New York, worse than West Coast. It's worse. Yeah.
Mm, no, I mean, I'm so surprised considering their governor is just so, seems to be such a caring and humane person. I'm surprised. How do you live there with that? I couldn't do it. My hat's off to you. I mean, you know, stay and fight the good fight in Miami. Clearly, this is your home. This is meant to be where you're meant to live there. And, you know, thank gosh, but I mean, you're stronger than me. I couldn't do it.
No, but sorry, I have to pass that on because that's how I feel. I look at these organizers that we're now working with and these activists, and I'm just like, my God, you guys are amazing that you just keep going, you know, fighting the good fight. And then using the film for it is a lot of pressure on me, but it's also it's also really, and how the, you know, the organizations have taken the film for themselves and are using it. It's just mind blowing and amazing for me to see, you know? So.
Well, it's called Raising Liberty Square. It is directed by Katya Essen, for making her first appearance on this podcast after many years, I might say. I can't believe this hasn't, we haven't done this before, and I apologize.
Me neither. I cannot believe it either. But anyhow, now I'm here.
That's the important
hopefully
part.
You invite me again.
What's that?
Hopefully you invite me again one day.
Absolutely will. Absolutely. In fact, you know, I seem to have a partiality towards, you know, even whether you're a German citizen or a former or whatever. I guess you have dual citizenship is my guess.
Yeah.
So,
I had to get it because of this film. I was only a resident, but people have told me, no, it's too tricky. You have to become a citizen to protect yourself.
Yeah, I didn't realize. Congratulations, I guess. My partner just also, like last year, after living here for 20-something years,
same.
She's Danish, and she just got hers. So.
You see? Yeah. I had
no Denmark reason. Wasn't Denmark. Until recently, though, unlike Germany, Denmark, you forfeited your Danish citizenship if you became an American citizen. Now that's no longer the case, and now she has dual citizenship. But she wouldn't have been able to do this, so that's why she finally ended up doing it. Because
Germany also doesn't make it easy on you. You really have to explain why you need it, you know? Yeah.
That's okay. You know, I mean, I guess. But yes, yeah. You have two passports. Yeah. All right. Well, what was I going to say? We'll put the link. I mean, I don't know if there's an easy link to YouTube as far as writing it out at the end of this thing, but we'll put the link to YouTube so people can see it. Are you saying that you can watch, I'm trying to get this out, but are you saying that you can watch the full film on the Independent Lens YouTube channel?
It's completely
free. It's important.
Completely free. Streaming free. People just need to put in the title and video, and then it comes up as the first.
All right, we'll embed it right on the page. They post this on my website when we put this up as soon as possible.
You.
That's great. Okay. It premiered at Hot Docs. It's been screening all over the world, it sounds like. And I hope to see you in Woodstock this fall. Again,
yeah, I hope I can make it. I mean, that was such an amazing award, you know, the Changemaker Award. You were there, right? When I got it,
I
couldn't believe it.
I think I gave you a nice, you know, hug or something.
Yes. I know we saw each other before or after, but that night, I don't, yeah. No, that was amazing. That's a special award, you know.
Yeah. Last thing I was going to say is, I you know, might be partial to German filmmakers these days. I just had on Wim Wenders.
Oh, I'm following Wim Wenders? Wow.
And there's been others. I've had Volker Schlondorf. I've had on Werner Herzog.
Oh.
So, and what's her name? Oh, God. Katharine, or she was another one of the filmmakers, you know, a female, part of the German New cinema back in the day, and she made a well-known film. Oh man, I shouldn't waste time because I don't have the information right in front of me, but I'm blanking on her name at the moment, but wow, she was terrific. And she was also from that German new cinema era, a female filmmaker,
right,
which I'm sure wasn't pretty typical back then.
No,
you know, but anyway, I'm excited that we got to talk, and I'm going to really encourage people to watch this documentary because it's kind of on some level will affect almost everybody.
Thank you. Yeah, it is to watch it here in Miami with people who have been fighting and people who are affected. It's a whole other. Our premiere, I normally would have a party after we couldn't do that because people were too
emotional.
We had a panel and we had food and people could talk, but it was like, yeah, it was incredibly intense and emotional.
Very intense, yeah. I bet. Yeah, it's hard. I mean, not for the sake of, or at the cost of repeating myself yet again, I'm always saying, even though I've done, you know, countless Q&As, moderating and such, they're actually the worst timing. Because they have happened as soon as the credits are rolling, and people are just still trying to process what they watched, and now they're supposed to ask thoughtful questions and have a kind of a dialogue. And it's not so easy sometimes, you know, because you are sometimes given a lot to digest, you know, and that's the case here. So.
Yeah, because there's no easy answer, you know. Right.
No,
so it's not the conversation, but it's there's no, it doesn't give an answer. Yeah.
Yeah. Other than everybody should have basic human rights, like a home.
like a home,
minimum
right?
Minimum income, healthcare. Yeah.
But, yeah. And not privatize stuff like homes and healthcare. And right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. But that makes us commies, kinkos.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh. Yeah, and that's a great thing to be in Florida, let me tell you.
I know, right? Exactly. I know, right?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Yeah, it's a hot button. All right, well, I'll let you go, and I'm looking forward to seeing you in person one of these days.
Yes, me too.
All right.
Thank you so much for having me, finally.
Yeah.
Following all these great German filmmakers.
Glad it. I'm all glad right. It worked out. Have a
thank
good
you. Bye, Adam. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks, everybody, for listening, tuning in. We'll be back next week, of course, with a brand new episode of the podcast. Thank you for tuning in. This is Adam Shartoff, your host of FilmWax. Until next time, take care of yourself and the ones you love.